So welcome to this fourth episode of my humble podcast. This is another very special interview. I'm very privileged to be able to interview a survivor, someone that I personally know, someone I've worked with for quite a while, who is showing herself, speaking up for the first time. So I'm very much looking forward to our conversation. I just want to remind you, again, I traveled very far to do this. Obviously, there's expenses involved, and it's all coming out of my pocket at the moment. So we do have a donate button that you can find on my website if you'd like to support my efforts to interview survivors and whistleblowers, all with this stated goal that we remove division and yet we speak truths, maybe unconventional truths. So thank you. It is now my great pleasure to begin our conversation here in Germany with my friend Helen. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
So I want to again thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I know I asked you, and you were one of the first people I asked.
Oh. I thank you, and I'm thanking my parts and others here to help. Yeah, thanks for this birth.
Yes, it's a really beautiful big step, and you know, having been working together with you, I've seen you in process, so it's very special that you decided to do this, you know, that you have the courage.
Yeah, I'm surprised myself.
Wonderful.
We were brought here, and yeah.
Yes. So I'm going to ask some questions, and as you know, I'm going to maybe sometimes respond similarly to when we talk otherwise. Can you give the audience something resembling an overview of what happened to you in your childhood?
Yeah, an overview. My life was more a back view, and because too many things became too drastic, too strange, too painful to look away from what was probably going on in the childhood on a level that was not the same as what I thought my childhood was, which was in a family that's more on a hippie family, I call it. And actually, for the longest time, I thought with the kindest and most open parents I could imagine, and free, a lot of freedom, and a beautiful place to live. So there was a lot of beautiful, wonderful stuff. But the things that were coming up then now and throughout all of my life, now I know they fit into this other level that was speaking of bloody things and very unimaginable, actually. But the body was speaking in fragments that this puzzle is coming together more and more. It seems to be speaking of having spent time in circles with more people, not just one person where I thought that was the abuse that I experienced, but many people. And as far as my body memories are, it seems like it was when I was very young, from age 0 to 3. But that's what I'm trying to put together. I can't say that that's where the limit is. Yeah, this is a kind of a very short overview.
Yes.
Yeah.
And those first 3 years, they were not spent in Germany, correct?
Yeah, Yeah, I was in America, in Kansas, lived in Kansas, and I have memories that were more on this, on the side of the memories that are, yeah, I'll call them the everyday memories. Yeah, like a tornado that happened once, and being in the basement, being carried down. I'm just mainly saying here that it is possible to have memories that go pretty far back to this time of life.
It is. Trauma memories can go back anytime.
Yeah, now I'm learning they go back to really any time and pretty clear, but in fragments. Yeah.
Yes. So because of the fragments, so we talk about parts work. So there's these little parts that have shown themselves and have through the body experience really let you know, if you will, what occurred there.
Yeah. And when certain fragments are really, those are the ones that are the most challenging, is when it's memories that where the voice comes through, and they're really the voice and the body are speaking of torture, and also, especially if there are more witnesses now who are there to, be part of that moment when the memory, when those memories come through, screaming. That seems to be very important for not to hide that anymore, and to come back to life. Yeah, really. I have the feeling with every memory, I'm again and again coming back to life. And this is one thing that just death has been so around all the time, in different forms, also in the form that my first pregnancy went until about the fourth, fifth month, and then the baby died. My first daughter, after she was born, then almost died. And then my second daughter was very sick and almost died. So I had the feeling I had to, it's my responsibility to find out what this whole death association is about. And yeah, so because it seemed like I was killing my children if I don't find out more and go deep inside, really turn inside. Drastically, radically. Yeah.
And so when you say there's witnesses, there were witnesses screaming, is this inner parts witnessing, or were there, or are you talking about there were more than one person there?
In the memory, there were more people there. And at the time, long time ago, the screams were not allowed to come out. It was very much necessary to not be visible, not be, audible?
Yeah, heard.
Heard. You heard. Yeah, and I learned to have a stone face. I still carry it around in my life, and I practicing breaking it up into something more lively. And what I just now meant with witnesses, I meant my family witnessing more and more these memories of when the torture comes through. Yeah.
Your family members being there, do you mean?
In this case, I meant mainly my family I have now, when the memories start coming up, and they're demanding to be loud, very loud, and then now more, not just my husband, not just myself, but and more people are witnessing it now, which makes it more real.
Yes. So there's this sense when you first get a memory that it can't be real, or it's not real, even though your body is telling you, even though maybe you can talk a little bit more about that process of integrating a memory, like the memory that you were talking about. You began to describe being taken down into a basement at a very young age, you know, toddler age. So accepting that we can have especially traumatic memories from any time, is there a way to describe what happened there and then perhaps speak a little bit about the process of integrating this memory?
That's interestingly, it's almost as if it comes at the same time. The memory is there, and then that is part of the integrating. Immediately. And like one memory is that I was lying on the surface, and I was then, and it's dark, but it's light enough to see that there's a baby, a newborn baby that is shown to me. And then it is put on my body, on my chest and belly. And I know there's the thought during this memory coming up, the question rises, is that mine? Is that my baby? And it's not answered, but just very soon this body is starting to bleed, and on my body, and it's very soon, it's just body parts. It's a dissected body, or that's what it seems like. And I can feel that it's warm, starting off warm, but then the liquids flowing off my body are cooling off. And while this memory was coming, my voice was also coming, and my body shaking very, very much, and yeah, there's very many things coming at the same time in a very short amount of time. It partly feels unreal, partly feels extremely real, and and that what's very relieving at last is to let it be there. The voices, the screams, the shaking. It just feels like at last, it's able to show. Yeah, and this was with the help of my therapist, and part of the integrating was possible, or this to show up at all, was because we were on the phone. He couldn't see me while this was coming up, and it's still that way, that it's very helpful not to be seen. even though I can, now there's more and more memories that only come up when I am seen. And it's more challenging, but I'm trying to find out if that's going to be very dangerous or not.
For sure.
Yeah.
So when you say that there's this question that this may be yours, so then this is not when you were a toddler.
Couldn't have been.
Couldn't have been.
I can only imagine that this was it was a scene that was choreographed.
So that you were told that this was your baby.
And I don't remember any voice telling me that, but I do have other body memories that do speak of really giving birth. But they're so separate from the from this one memory with the baby being put on my body that I couldn't swear that that belongs together and that I must have been older than in that case.
Yeah.
It's too fragmented right now to mm-hmm. be sure. Yeah.
So even though it is fragmented, there is this memory was so significant and it assaulted you in a way, you know, you could have it, you were not seen, but it came and you were assaulted with it from all sides. It was very, and even though there is this, it's very extreme, the integration begins with the relief of allowing the screams, the reactions that you could never have before to be present, yes?
Yeah, very much, yeah. It just seems like straight back to life.
Yeah, and that brings you back to life. And then did it also then explain this death team in that sense around your own children, yes?
I think so. And of course, many, many other memories that were around being very close to death. I think they're, now okay, I'm saying I think, but I have memories of not being able to be being suffocated, or I think water was also involved, or being very close to fire. And it felt very close to death, and as if it happened over and over and over again while being watched very closely. As if to see, find out where the limit is, or where the boundary to dying is, and then bring me back or keep me on the side of life. But this, as if I'm on purpose being brought to this close to death, or around this border, this what would you call it?
The limit, right. Right to the edge, which is, by the way, very common in mind control. With me, it was done, it was a punishment for getting something wrong, but then it was also part of the training to be either suffocated or drowned. Fire was used differently, but in my case, those two were used specifically to create the states of unconsciousness where then the spirit leaves the body, which then magnifies your psychic abilities. So it was very directed. It was very specific the way that it was used in my case. So you feel that there was more organization around your experiences also, that yes, you say you could have died, but somehow I felt that the people who were abusing me in this context, torturing me in this context of the mind control, were very good at knowing how far they could take it so that I would just not die.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yeah. Yeah. And also, it seemed like that they, I would even use your sentence of being very good in my inner world, I'm just always shocked how attached I am to the people that were there to do these things, and it being put into this back and forth situation of dying and being brought back to life, and as if, yeah, terrible pain and then absolute gratitude to be relieved from the pain again and again and again. And so I've been waiting for hate to come around, for anger to come around, and it's just, I'm sure it's there, but it's still very, very strong that I will feel more the side that I have to be grateful, and also I have to take care of the ones that were the perpetrators. Yeah.
And that, of course, your life depends on it. Your life depends on the attachment, the emotional attachment with them that is all put in there, that any child would be attached to the adults that are taking care of them, supposedly. So you would anyway be attached to anyone who's handling you, but then that attachment gets completely perverted with the life-death situation, that knowing you can die any moment, your attachment increases, and your love, in this case, then fear-based love, I think would very much increase, and so it would be completely natural, really, that you would be so attached to them. But interesting also that you had a feeling of caretaking. So are we speaking now of your family members or other people?
No, I really mean the people that I associate some details, through some details as some perpetrating qualities I see now in the present. That comes up quickly, but this caretaking, yeah, I think I probably have strong caretaking sides for my family as well, but I really mean I'm myself unhappy with the ones that are still trying to take care of the perpetrator sides, if anybody shows up. I think it just seems like a big lie, and but very much conditioned into me, and I'm, by noticing this, I'm a bit more empathic with myself and patient.
Of course.
Yeah.
And this is your own family, rather than strangers that came into your life, and then you still have those feelings. So I had strangers come in, and they became parental figures, and then I had that attachment with them, but I also had it with my own family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I understand very well those feelings of attachment and, yes, the anger, you know. Yeah, it's nice to get to that too, when you do.
Yeah, I love it when others reflect it back to me, or I try to watch animals. I think I had to watch many people in general how to behave at all. Now I have this feeling I have to learn things, how to nourish myself, or that's how it works to be alive, and kind of tickle it out of me. I used to put a lot of pressure wanting to come out of numbness and this death associated life. And I made a decision very early. I wanted, this is not right. It's not right to be numb. And it's very important for me to come back to life, but it had to be in many, many, many thousands of steps, and because life seemed totally overwhelming, even happy sides of life. Now putting it together with these memories coming, is more understandable I can orient it back to where it belongs.
Absolutely, and I really love that we're getting this really clear picture of how difficult it is. You know, you live with something that's so heavy, but you don't know what it is, so you feel completely numb. Not exactly the same, I would say, as a depressed state, correct?
It's not the same. I resisted so much calling myself depressed, and when I learned more of dissociation, and I had helpers who taught me so much about it, and I had to first grow the capacity to understand dissociation better. And now I can say, yes, there are depressed things and suicidal states very much part of my life, but they seem like not from me at the same time. And I never was close to really taking action, but it just as if it were constant during phases, constantly just speaking to me. Maybe, yeah, a suicide program or discard program.
So yeah. Let's focus on that for a moment, because they're two different programs.
Yeah.
So suicide programming, what I received was, you know, this repeat, repeat very loudly while being tortured or traumatized. Or in one event, I was actually sexualized while being told, if my man leaves me, I have to kill myself. So it was to connect it back specifically to one perpetrator, if he would leave me. So it's this deep repetition connected to trauma. So if this trauma emotionally occurs again, or if this memory begins to come up, or if this, I see this face of this perpetrator, if that comes before me, then I need to kill myself. And then discard programming is what I've heard from other survivors, that they were, instead of, they would have the slow suicide where they cannot take care of themselves at all. So they fall into drug use, homelessness, and so forth. And then basically they become sort of the disenfranchised of the, and then end up dying an early death because of that. They just get, feel that they're drawn to that. They don't deserve anything. They don't deserve to participate in a regular life. And so that's the programmation they received. And so it's true that when you get this, these messages, what my particular one, which had to do with my man leaves me, it didn't just work for this one man. It worked for many men. So when I got that, it was this voice, but it wasn't really my voice that I heard. So, you know, if it's interesting to perhaps speak a little bit more about that, that it's not, doesn't sound like your voice. Do you have the memory of being programmed particularly of or not?
Why I say programmed is mainly because, yeah, I thought I never felt the drive to take action and really take the step to leave the body forever or kill myself. But it seems like there's a huge, it just pops up, death to be the solution, to get away from very unbearable inner states, intolerable states. And there's been a long process of first, I just believed it's, I just can't take life. I wasn't made for this world. But then through understanding how specific it can be, that, I can, strange to put it into words, or impossible, because it feels like a very many different aspects coming together, and partly one thing that helps is to say program and then it goes away. And that's where it seems most I can grasp it better, to think this, that is a program, because the moment I
you name
expose it. Expose it, name
right.
it.
Yeah.
It changes.
Fantastic.
But that happens in very different qualities again. So either it's very many different and repeating programs, or the process of going deeper and deeper into memories that my system can tolerate and then heal. That's how I would explain it right now.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, it sort of also gives a little clearer picture of the complex nature, you know, of the healing from this kind of abuse that programming is so vast. Mm. So for you to say program is sufficient to take you out of the impulse, let's say, that is programmed into you. And it doesn't, you know, it's just naming it gives you the distance. And that's what we need, you know, to create distance from our thoughts in order to look at them and then, you know, see maybe where they came from. But where they came from, that's not just nothing.
And there was one particular moment where my husband, he has a very hard time seeing the suffering that he has to witness almost every day. And he just once said, okay, if you feel like you can't bear life the way it is right now, then let's plan for it. Let's plan to end it. And that immediately helped me come out of it, because his care to love me so much, to let me go, that was very central, that helps me through similar situations that now come up every once in a while again. I agree what you said, that these thoughts around wanting or the what I would right now call suicide programming comes when more memories start to come up. It's directly connected to that, and I never know how long it's going to take until they are born. And it feels like for a long time I'm going to try to leave through dissociation or through the thought, yes, I can leave the world if I wanted to have that choice. But his care to let me go, but also naming it, just there's somebody who names it. And that's why I also think it's bringing everything out from this dark and silencing state and conditioning. Yeah, programming is conditioning. So
it's beautiful, because in the network, the conditioning is all about you not having a choice. And so pushing you, you know, to if this happens, if A happens, if you have memories, then B, you have to, that means B, you have to then kill yourself. And then if someone like your husband who loves you offers you the freedom, I think it breaks the program.
Yeah, it sure did very quickly. It broke the programming of just now lost it.
You said it also broke the programming, another programming?
That people around me are silent about it, but oh gosh, it's gone. It was something important.
It'll come back. No worries.
Yeah.
It broke the programming of the suicide programming. Because you had the choice, the freedom to choose.
Yeah,
which you didn't have.
Now I'm remembering. It broke the emotions broke out at that moment. The pain was released at that moment, with his feeling safe with him. There's a very, very strong impulse. Never my stone face. That's what I meant with saying stone face. very strong not to show any emotions, but at that moment they just came flooding out, and so that was dispelled.
Oh wow!
That Fluch.
Fluch, is that fly?
That is a spell. The spell was broken.
The spell was broken.
It was broken.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wow.
So many spells were broken throughout all those years. Mm. And I'm looking back now that I'm even recognizing in childhood where I thought I didn't have any symptoms for the longest. Only they started when I had children. But now I'm looking back and I'm seeing them all over those years. And
you see the symptoms.
See the symptoms.
That you did have.
And maybe, yeah. And maybe some spells broken even then. Yeah.
Yeah, the spell's broken because it's true, it's conditioning, and then your husband offered this unconditional. It's an interesting, you know, that to offer you to have the freedom to kill yourself, which is unconventional to say the least, then somehow still that was the unconditional love that you needed to then allow that you to feel free, and then all these spells to be broken. And so it's an interesting term to use, the spells were broken, because we have satanic ritual abuse and we have witchcraft, which is sort of goes hand in hand, the dark witchcraft, I guess, which goes hand in hand with the also, I would say, I don't see that Satanism is light ever, but that there is, you know, in certain levels of the satanic circles, in certain groups of the satanic church or the temple of Satan, these things do happen. So do you feel that do you have any sense of the organization that was sort of around the people that put you in these horrific situations?
The things that I remember or that just come up is in the form of colors or fire, darkness. Usually there was also a scene in a very bright light and white light, but that was, it seemed different in the quality, but connected with electrodes put it on my body. So a very white and bright light and very simple room. And I sensed the presence of one person there. And in other surroundings, it seemed mostly inside, and as I said, dark, and there's just flashes of quite a bit of blood and body parts that are visible. These pieces are very fragmented, so I hardly ever see a longer scene that seems to be belonging together. Only the puzzle pieces if they're put together, but I can't swear then that they belong together. There's one scene that seemed to be a longer, I was present then in my memory. I was not dissociating too much during the memory. Was when I was in a hallway, and somehow it seemed like there were wires on touching my body, holding me in place, and also my eyes were fixated in some way, so I wasn't able to close them. I was being forced to watch a scene where a girl's upper body, I didn't see her face, I was kind of only seeing her chest, where her breast was being, with a scalpel, scalpel was being dissected. And I must have been, at that time, definitely dissociated. And while I'm saying it, I am not in touch with the feelings around it. But during this process, also with my therapist, of going through this memory, I could put some pieces together, and it was a bit of a longer scene, and it was dark, and there was the perpetrator. I see his hand and doing the work, but I don't see the face, and there's a lot of my eyes trying to close and trying not to see certain aspects.
Right. Except I also was forced to watch things with clamps, special clamps, an instrument with metal, basically keeping the eyes open, forced open for a long time. Actually, I was made to watch certain films, but you were forced to watch this, and you were held in place by ropes.
Wires. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you couldn't move. Your head had to be in this position. You couldn't look away. And you were forced to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's another thing. This when people say they're sorry, and there's not that many because they don't know, but it does a certain thing. It's strange. I probably still put it away, and I can't quite let it in, but thank you anyway. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry for you for having to go through that. I'm sorry for the victim that was there, that was either dead or being killed. And I'm sorry for me and all of us that have had to live through all of these horrendous things.
Yeah, I'm also very sorry. It's impossible to put it into words, really. Maybe that's why I react to the word I'm sorry, because it's so humongous, so huge, so complex, so impossible, unimaginable that,
it is unimaginable. That's why we're trying to talk about it in a way that somehow gives a little bit of a sense of what it was like, you know, not just bringing out the gory details, but just talking also the process of integrating. And so we've spoken a little bit about some of the things that you endured. Now, from knowing you, and we haven't spoken about anything about the sexual abuse now, obviously I just don't want to, you know, leave that out, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Would you?
That's a big part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are my first memories. And I just had things kind of, life, when life happens, triggering happens. All of life can be triggering, or life quality things, and so that was my first. I can't call it certainty, but when I knew about the phenomena that something like that exists, I very quickly knew that is part of my life, and I just felt too related to people who were very open and had much clearer memories. And they just came through the body, or come through the body, very strongly. And that's of sometimes as if I'm watching it from a distance, looking down on a baby body, and
that being you,
that being me, and a finger being inserted into the vagina, and only years later, then what fitting to what my system was able to tolerate, the intensity, and actually the first for unbearable. I just spent so many nights with feelings that were unbearable high arousal, and not clearly sexual arousal on my side, but as if, and often I had the feeling I'm feeling the perpetrator actually, as my way of being able to protect from being the victim. And I'm feeling the side of the perpetrator in very complex ways. Empathy, but also, I'm very surprised myself still, but also the brutality, the, what I say, this German word, Rausch.
Excitement,
but times 1,000.
Yes.
Multiplied. And then understanding very well the drive to do these things, because it brings such feelings of aliveness multiplied many times.
You feel the high.
Yeah. And so it's, there's where I feel like, wow, yeah, I understand why you're doing this, and why not, and what, why have empathy with the victim and the, all of the pain side, because
you were so young when this started. You were a baby, right?
That's my impression, yeah.
Yeah.
Very strong, yeah.
So then, as a baby, you attune yourself completely to your environment because you have no physical capabilities at all. You cannot survive without the grown-ups. So when the grown-ups, I think it's natural for babies to completely attune themselves to their environment. So if your environment was filled with perpetrators, I can imagine that as a baby you would have been, like, the attunement is to get your needs met. Mm-hmm. So if your need was to give in this way, so to help the perpetrator, then to, for you, your spirit to go inside of them, to feel everything, you, like you say, I understand it, because as a baby you had to, you know? You had to. And just to be clear, you're saying you can understand it. It's not that you approve in any way, or you would never do anything of the kind, just to be very clear, because there, you know, there is this empathy that you have.
It was used. It seemed like that phase of life was, and the biological needs were used. It's still hard to imagine that somebody'd be that clever and so cold-blooded to really, and know enough about, it's a science to know how trauma works. And
On a
baby, especially. And it seemed like also I was a research object to find out even more. So, yeah, the sexual abuse, I'm trying to come back to that because that was, and so, but it, I do have strong memories of oral abuse and more than one person being there, kind of orgy scenes. But it almost seemed like this was on the side somehow. It's just part of all of it. First, with my first memories when I was a teenager going into the 20s, that seemed like, oh, that's the big thing. It was more just in the family through my father. But now, when more memories of more people and more scenes are coming up, it's just the sexual thing is not really the most central.
Right. In many cases, but the sexual seems to always be part of whatever the purpose is. Survivors that have been experimented on, and we'll talk about that, or survivors that have been used for soldiering. However, sexual abuse was always part of it. even though it wasn't a side in a way for them.
And even as if to first prepare that this is something that's not, it doesn't bring blood necessarily. It's impossible to say that something happened to me. It's not recognized by my mother or whoever was there to take care of me. But I'm kind of primed to then tolerate, or not tolerate, but to go through more and not speak. Yeah, maybe that's the priming of silencing. Yeah.
The sexual abuse.
Yeah. And then silencing first the sexual abuse, and then that working as a silencing tool for all the other abuse. I really, then not too long ago, had a realization that always this question, why silence? Why not speak about it? Why not show? And I know there were signs that could have been noticed, definitely now, watching my own daughters growing up and me being hyper alert, trying to notice everything. But one big reason was not to speak out is now because I didn't want to overwhelm myself. I knew that the moment I would open my mouth and start to speak and to reach out, I would then overwhelm my own system entirely, which would have been, I think, impossible. I would have gone crazy, or I would have shown emotion connected with that pretty. And from there on, don't know how that would have been taken, of course. Maybe nobody would have reacted, but if somebody would have reacted, even that seemed impossible to survive. Strange mixture again. But that was a very important realization I had recently, and Yeah.
So again, thank you for speaking.
Yeah.
But yes, in my case, I don't know if this was the same for you, but the overwhelm of speaking out is that you then bring it into the reality. Then it's real. If you say it, it's real. If you don't say anything, the denial works better, and it's the, in my case, my family's denial was so strong, I kind of, piggybacked on their denial that helped me.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I'm still happy when I notice my parents. I don't have much contact with, especially my father, but I'm always relieved, or parts of me are relieved, when denial is very obvious. Yeah.
You mean that you see his denial.
Yeah, his or my mother's, and I'm like, oh, thank God.
And you're grateful because you don't want to have...
Yeah, why? I'm probably the high... there's parts that are still trying to avoid the high arousal, and that happens. And it does happen with my mother sometimes. She suddenly has a realization when I show something, talk about something, and she... it goes deep. It's very palpable. It gets very emotional for a short time. It comes out of denial. And recently my therapist said, well, then that can be even more proof that it's real. And I was, yeah, right. Because again, sides of me were trying to say, well, even if it's real for her showing up now, it's still something that is then, I did it to her. I was the perpetrator. Yeah, I did. That's again where...
You're making her feel bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry about that too. I'm just going to say
it. Yeah, I'm sorry as well, really. It's, yeah. That's very painful.
So it's not really coming out of denial. I mean, the denial is that it's about you. It continues. I mean, she feels something, and then there's like maybe a flicker of...
yeah.
But there's no responsibility because it's all your fault. of making her feel this way.
And here's again, maybe it's a program. There's a sentence that says, I have to carry it, and I want to carry it. I want to carry, let me take the pain of the perpetrators even. Yeah, I'll carry it all. It's totally, what's the word?
It's a martyr.
Yeah, it's, how can I even believe that I have the strength, and I don't have the strength to carry that. But the voice telling me, mm-hmm. inside me, is very strong, that says, I will carry it. And yeah, I just hope that healing will continue to relieve me of that.
Well, as a child, you did have to carry it, first of all, because it was given you, and you had no choice. So,
Maybe the voice is saying, I still have a choice. It's trying to tell me that it's a powerful, to trying to feel some power in the powerlessness. And
exactly. Yeah. But it's also true that you do have the strength, not so much to carry their traumas necessarily, but you have anyway, because they put it on you. Mm-hmm. So you've been carrying it anyway, and you do have the strength. And what I mean by strength is then, look, you've had the strength with this mindset, I carry it all for them, which I did too, I'm the martyr. That means as a martyr is different from a victim. A martyr is the one who silently carries everything, but you're the one who goes to healing. So you do have strength that clearly the perpetrators don't have.
Mm-hmm. Trying to understand. Yeah.
Yeah, the child that carries everything is very strong.
It's amazing how children are able to. I mean, I'm looking around at children and I'm seeing that they're bearing the reproaches they're getting from their grown-ups. And it's so, it seems like, wow, that child can take more. So it's given more. I'm so grateful that I think something in me decided to do it differently with my daughters most of the time. I'm very sorry that I got them mixed up with, especially my older daughter. I couldn't touch her. That was one of the biggest pains. Or I touched her, but I wasn't present. And that was, I tried to work for hundreds of therapy sessions on this. And I got as far as to really connect with the part that wanted to run away screaming as soon as my daughter needed to hold me or be held by me and hold my hand. And I felt more real then when I let this escaping and fight and flight happen. And then I felt like I could be more present with her. And I was able to explain to her, and she hasn't given up trying to hug me, and she knows that she says, oh, here, she calls it, the inner kittens are trying to get away, stay, she'll call me back. And she's very patient, and yeah, I was very, very, very worried she would be so traumatized for having a mother and not to be able to just be bodily present.
Yes, but it keeps being worked out. Yeah. And obviously, it's not the same kind of trauma that you had by any stretch of the imagination. So it seems that you having your daughters, the first, you know, wanting to overcome this death theme and go deeper into that, which you then did, and then, you know, want to be better so that you can be present that for your daughters, is like the greatest motivation in terms of you facing this darkness. And but again, it does require the strength, tremendous strength, to first survive in the whatever ways that we do. But you did, you survived. That's to say, that's your true self survived, part of your true self survived, and then the healing brings it out more and more and more, and that's ongoing integration process. So no, I do think you You know, I know that martyr very well. I always thought I can carry it for all of them. And then you do as a child because you don't have a choice. And then the voice keeps saying that you carry it for all of them. But then if you heal, that's when you need all that strength, you know, to heal.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you are carrying it a little bit for those perpetrators as well, because you're, as you break this cycle, you are giving them something as well, I believe.
And I've had amazing helpers, and blessed. That somehow doesn't fit with these drastic inner contradictions inside to have be so grateful. And at the same time, I had to, there was in Germany, you have this saying, to fit under one hat. How does all that fit under one hat? Unter ein Hut bringen or passen. And to feel grateful for, and the most amazing helpers have been the most hurt ones. And that's the crazy part, where the ones who understand have been very hurt are the ones who, without speaking, understand.
The opposite,
and I have that word on my tongue.
Okay. On the other end, you have the ones who have not been through it themselves, or something. Were you saying?
Or the ones that have been there's to be able to carry each other through it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like just miracles. Carrying us and. Through from one step to the next, from one fragment to the next, and each fragment is quite unbearable. And then again, here comes the voice saying, "Ach, I shouldn't make a big deal of it." It's that's a very big, strong voice. But there's for myself and many and others and victims. Survivors is better than to say victims. To speak out and make use of the energy that is given to us every day again. And my husband has been. I don't know where that's coming from. That he's stuck around and. Yeah.
Maybe because you're a wonderful person.
And partly it's the capacity for the nervous system to protect itself and to pull back in some safe place. Sometimes these safe ways are healthy, sometimes not so healthy, and they have to be changed over time. But... even for those, I've learned to be grateful. And,
sure.
Yeah.
Again, the gratitude is, I would say it's a spiritual component of the healing, you know, that I too feel very grateful. There's this gratitude because for me, it's that I'm able to love that I wasn't able to do at all.
Mm.
And I've learned to love in the healing processes. Each part receives the understanding and the love, the reflection from first someone else who's there, who's kind, and then myself even. I can get the distance and then bring that understanding and that love even to my own parts and find healing that way. But it always comes from beyond.
Beyond.
Just to align with the truth that actually is the same as love on the spiritual level. To align with that force is such a beautiful, such a really beautiful. And then when you come from so far, like you and I have, then you have so much, I feel the gratitude is so poignant, because when you know what you've lived through and you really know, you know, you can breathe fresh air and you can feel grateful, you know, or something just very simple. And
very simple. But yeah, I can only say that it feels, and there's many names for it, but I can see, there's God. It feels suddenly sparkling, and it can be driving in the car and it suddenly feels like it's, something's lighting up, or I'm able to see sparkle in others, and everything seems sweet suddenly. Yeah, and I know that that is possible because it's also comes from where it's very dark, where that's where it also lives in a way. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And that, yeah. And that's where, again, I'm very grateful my daughters have picked up this sparkly stuff. And now they're having to bear being a little different in their friend circles or in school. But they're still, it seems strong enough to... yeah, head for that side. And
yeah, so just a beautiful, you know, it's clear that when there's that light that's there, that is what guides us through. So I just wanted to clarify a little bit, because I, also because I know you, you know, so we spoke about the first 3 years, which was in the U.S., and then there was definitely that abuse then, and but then clearly there also things happened when you came back to Germany, correct?
Yeah, because my body then in the memories looks older, feels older, still, my memories are so, they're just mainly strong body memories. I can't say mainly, but that's why I, for the longest time, thought this was all before I developed speech or language and learned to speak. But then it gets mixed up with having to learn maybe new to speak or also to be silent. It's hard to say exactly. It's vague. And there's a strange mixture of these places feeling like home and not like home.
And what is home then?
That what is home? I think it's, and it feels like the body attaching very much to whoever is there, and also to the perpetrators, attaching for not just safety, but to bear, to be able to survive for survival reasons, to attach to people, even though I can't see their faces. There's, I know that in one memory there's a circle of people, and I know they're men. I can't see their faces because it's dark with cloth around them, the heads, and maybe a circle of 5-6 men.
And you are in the middle?
And I'm in the middle, yeah. And it's always, it seems like I was too young to really realize what country I am in, but just the age can give a hint. And most of my memories seem when I was very young, meaning before three.
Yes. I also wanted to just clarify also, because you talked about your father, and of course, you know, the I'm assuming the sexual abuse was started by your father, but then how was that afterwards? Because I just have trying to get a sense of his involvement.
Oh, yeah. I then first had memories with him, but then there was a second man in America. And then in the circles, as soon as it had to do more with more perpetrators, more men around, I don't remember any woman at all, which might change with more memories coming, but in those circles, he wasn't there. I don't feel his presence. And that could be because my system is busy with other stuff, but there might have been one moment where I felt I was holding his hand, and then, but then passed on to strangers, then for me, strangers.
And do you have a sense of what happened in those circles and in what kind of environment? Because you said it's the night, they're wearing cloth, they're in a circle around you.
It all came to, at different times, but this one memory with holding, and my body is very small, but I can stand. I'm standing, I'm not at that moment. And I'm feeling the presence of my father. It feels familiar. But then that's where there were flames, and it seemed like, just to me first, it seemed like flames. I have to cross those flames. I have to walk across or be carried across. And that's where my father doesn't follow. And it turns out then I see that these, what's burning are bones and bodies. And I'm brought to, I have then other clothes on that are very, very long, way too long for my little body. And I'm put on a big, tall, or like a throne. It's a big chair, hard. It's wood or even metal. And it's way too big for me. And from there on, there's I see a lot of movement of people moving around, but it's vague. It's also dark, but it seems like there are a lot of movement going on, walking around, and I just, the main feeling is that why there's this question in me: why is this happening to me? And why am I the only one in such a chair? And I feel the silky cloth. It's a very thin. I think transparent even in a way, but it feels very silky, and I like that feeling in that memory. But it's also that was my way of dissociating. Often is going into the surface of my body. And because there's other ways of dissociating, of going into away from the body entirely, but I often have the feeling I just go to the surface of my body and feel then, for example, the textures of cloth or in great detail. And I'm kind of clinging to that with my mind, to this cloth that I'm in.
Sure. Of course.
And then from then on, that's the end. I don't know anymore.
Now, I have heard these kinds of rituals described, by other survivors, that there's a test to pass, which then clearly you did. You walked through this fire. It was unfortunately a fire of burning bodies. And then you were put on a throne, which is sort of an initiation of sorts, even though you are not wishing to be initiated. You're too small to choose to do that. Yes, I've definitely heard it from several other survivors that they were, that this happened to them at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know particularly which ritual, which ritual is associated with that, but it's not the first time I hear it that way. But your father is there, but then he lets go of your hand, and then afterwards he's sort of less in, not so much in the picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's not so important in that sense. Mm-hmm. That the people that you need to attach to are other people, the men.
There's one memory where I am very small. It's definitely before three. And I see a grown-up sitting in a chair, and I rushed there because for consoling or for and because I'm afraid, and that feels like that's where I have to go. It's just a biological drive for mammals to go to look for safety with another person, and I get there, but I'm in total and in sudden shock because I realize when I crawl onto the lap that it's cold, the body is cold, and I'm in shock. I don't know, is it a doll? Is it, again, something choreographed? Is it a person that's not alive anymore? I don't see blood, but it's hard. It's a very strange texture, and I don't think I feel skin, but I'm... And from there on, dissociated through the shock and don't know anymore. With my therapeutic methods, I try to stay a bit more present to heal a bit of this shock and to not spend so much energy into dissociation now. And I had the sensation of leaving and coming back to this scene to find out a bit more of what that was. It's not a ritual, but it's something to scare a child very much.
Yes, horrendous. And also, if you were looking to be consoled, then there's a strong message there, from the network perspective, that you cannot find it,
Yeah, that's really very fitting. It I think something gave up very deeply of looking for, and then again with what I said before, I have to carry it alone. I can somehow, I'm supposed to, so I can carry it alone, right now it comes really strongly in order not to ever go look for help anywhere. Yeah, that was a strong message.
Yeah. So on the surface, your family was sort of hippy-dippy, very... I guess those are often friendly people... And then sometimes in that sort of atmosphere, there's no boundaries. Mm. So in a way, you get even spoiled, or, it's sort of a mix between spoiled and neglect, that you can do anything? Was it like that for you?
Yeah, spoiled. For example, I wet the bed very long until I was 10, and as a kind of an attempt to stop that I wouldn't do that anymore. There were methods of giving me a certain Belohnung, what is that in English?
Rewards.
And one was to go to a place where I love to take care of a pony or two, and on the weekends. So I, for me, this whole family every weekend went to drive out, and so I, yeah, and it seemed like it was all for me, and all had to do with this trying to get rid of this wetting the bed, which was probably a sign that something wasn't quite okay. And reward, and at the same time, yeah, lacking care. Not look closely. So really, this family was a lot about saving animals. My father's a social worker, a professor of social work. He's very proud of his work, and in me, there's a lot of, well, he saved many people's lives. Yeah, my mother, she was all into going to organizations to save the world. Yeah, they were world savers. But eventually, in therapy, I was asked, now, and then what about you? And this thing is like, okay, about me? Still very uncomfortable that it's about me, like, yeah. Even in an interview that, yeah, I'm given that opportunity is to take, to be, accept and receive that, really. Okay. But of course, there's sides in me that want to demand that it should be about me as well.
Well, it should finally be about you, because that attention about going to, you know, the pony farm or whatever, that's a lot of so-called positive attention on a what was obviously a problem that they wanted to fix in you, that they weren't going to go to the real cause, which was very dark. So you're actually getting this negative imprint, because it's all about your problem that you're doing all these fun things. So you're getting the message that you should think they're so great, but you're just failing. Or am I wrong?
Yeah. It turned into a, for me, like an addiction to horses, and yeah, that's what it was for a while. And then really, my mind just spun around wanting to have horses, and I drove people crazy with that. Yeah, now I can see how these obsessions were protecting me from overwhelm, and keeping the family in a safe denial state.
Yeah. Yeah, that they're such nice people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what was happening was unspeakable to you. Completely unspeakable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was always a sense of danger, and for example, we had soldiers come stay with us for a Christmas, as a good cause. You know, my family wanted to, the soldiers that couldn't go home to their own families, they could take in some soldiers, and I was just.
Were these American soldiers?
Yeah,
then
American soldiers. Yeah, and at that time I was 7 or 8, and I was, I could say, in love with these soldiers immediately, which now I would say that's strange.
That makes sense.
And I was ashamed. I know I was ashamed. And I was also afraid all night. I think I couldn't sleep all night because I was afraid they were going to rape me. But during the day, I wanted to play. We played board games, which now I could, throughout the childhood of my children, I couldn't play any games without being numb or triggered or something. But at that time, I just wanted to play. It was more like an obsession. I was getting on everybody's nerves. So that, for example, I was scared. There was a lot of fear that, again, had to be dissociated because it was into different parts.
Yeah, it was both the attachment and the pleasing, which you had to do before, and then also the fear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, both.
That's a very strange side to come to peace with, is the side that wants to connect to and, yeah, please and that's interesting, other meetings with soldiers where I was just standing beside myself saying, what am I doing trying to console them so deeply? And it just, it fits very well to this still strong impulse in me to console my father. It feels like a big lie at the same time, but
and also very common.
Yeah, and then other people called my father a psychopath, and it's both there.
Well, it is also common from narcissistic parents who are also then, you know, crossing those boundaries, like there's no boundaries left at all, but that this is emotionally a very young person, so there is always that victim feeling when you're around them.
Exactly.
And, you know, what he's going to do is, you know, you're the little person who loves him by nature. From being his daughter, you know, every little girl loves their father.
Mm-hmm. I did, yeah.
And then just to use that then to receive the love, you know, or semblance of love that he never had. Mm. That's what creates that attachment, of course. And then it gets magnified with the abuse that you have to do it even more or else. Mm. So it's very understandable, and I understand. And, you know, again, I want to thank you for being so brave to speak about this and to speak so honestly about all the different aspects of not only the horrific memories, but also the whole process of slow process of integration, of speaking about the dissociation and the different parts and, you know, not trying to create a story when you don't have one, you know. My story is I've put it together little by little over the years and it keeps evolving because as more puzzle pieces are put in place, the story evolves as well. And someone who has never been in a healing process does not understand any of this at all. It's like, if the world is divided in two, it's people who have a healing process, who have, you know, broken through the narcissism, because I could say that when I was young, I was pretty narcissistic myself, you know, so egocentric from all the trauma. Yeah. To break through that, to open up, to open the heart, to let the heart break and let the feelings in, to begin this process of growth. Now, if you haven't done that, you have no idea what we're talking about. When we're talking about spirituality and increasing in love, somebody who hasn't been through that, they have no idea. Mm. It's interesting that those are the people who will also not believe and so forth. But most people who have a sense of truth just know.
Mm.
And I think you're just such a beautiful example of someone who's really in process and at the same time just so brutally honest with yourself and with others now today. Mm. So again, I just want to thank you very, very much for being here.
Yeah, thanks. A lot has to do with being able to work with you. And I've, for the longest time, I thought, and that's what I've been told with therapists, that you don't have to remember. The body has to be able to have its fight and flight completions. And so I was hoping for that. I did a lot of that. And then, but then when, not too long ago, it's been like 2 or 3 years ago that I have had to really say, okay, now I'm going to have to open to more possibilities of memories belonging to these organized abuse circles. Because it's einfach, I'm starting to speak German suddenly. No worries. It's too drastic, it's too much, too intense, too bloody, too horrific. That's when I noticed it is important to allow that possibility to, because otherwise the pictures will just stay hidden.
Yes, I think it's actually a bypass to say that you don't have to have the memories. You do need to have the memories, otherwise you don't have the truth. The memory is the truth. And you do need it. You can't bypass it. You can't let it get out of you. It won't go out of your body if you don't have it, if you don't know what is out, is getting coming. Yep. If there's some energy leaving your body for a moment, it'll just come back. It's actually what perpetrators do. They try to run away from their trauma and they get a release for a moment. And then they have to do it again because it just doesn't fill anything. It doesn't fill that hole. But once you have the memories, then you're beginning to fill that emptiness inside. You're beginning to know what happened and therefore who you are.
And that's why, in a crazy way, it was very relieving to then say, okay, now we're opening up. And just a strong... And even my husband was relieved, as if he could sense all this time. It was too tight, kept too small all this time. And here again, with one reason why the silence thing goes on is like I was in a self-help group with my friend who's been present here, helping in her way. We tried to protect each other from triggering things. And so we never spoke out any details and connected, not violently, but silently, deeply, and somehow with knowing, very strong knowing. And so self-help groups are helpful in many ways, but at the same time, they can be, maybe I used it to keep it hidden in some ways as well. And I had to leave the group in order to open up to, this violence that came in an organized and ritualized way.
Well, it's very difficult to find any space to really be able to freely share about those things. That includes anonymous groups, for example. It's hard to find a group. It's hard to find a therapist, as we know. Someone to be able to hold that, someone to have done enough work on themselves that they can know that this darkness exists and then also be able to hold it for someone else.
And in these self-help groups, or the one that I was in, it was a screaming silence.
A
screaming silence. And for, I would say, 2 years, I worked on being able to bear that and the things that were just coming at me visually, energetically mostly, I think. And just Yes, something. And somehow now I can speak because that homework was done years ago. Yeah, I think, and it might seem very cold-blooded the way I can speak or we can speak now because it's not very emotional. Right now I'm not crying, screaming, and doing all the stuff that, that is there almost every day and in phases because, yeah, a lot of stuff was kind of integrated or worked on a long time ago in its very own way. Luckily, there are healing, self-healing tendencies, drives in ourselves. It's amazing.
Yes, it's amazing. And so now we do have a space and more people are open, very beautiful progression, you know, over the years that I've noticed in people's ability to hold. And I'm sure that many people will be able to hold our conversation and the truth that you've spoken. And as a very last question, I wanted to ask, do you have a sense of how it ended for you?
Recently, I got a very strong impulse memory that it was my father who brought me out. I was so surprised. And that is that that's also a reason why I'm that strengthens the attachment to him, even though I'm not in contact with him very much. I can't say anything about the logistics
or your age
or my age. I'm pretty sure there's more going to be coming through me to if it's necessary, and it's also quite clear in as a sense inside myself that I was not interesting anymore. I was too dangerous for the circles. For
that's the key.
There's something that came out, or maybe I was too dumb or too clever or...
Too dangerous means that you are who you are, sitting here today speaking out. It's not as if you were not that same person then, even though you were a child. And then I was also considered a problem and dangerous. And, you know, for their purposes, we certainly are. So if you don't really want fully to be part of it and you have that distance, then you're not, well, it's not that they don't want you. It's that, you know, it's surprising though that then your father was able to take you out.
And
but yes, again, it seems that what you said is I became dangerous to them or whatever, too much of something that they don't want. I think is that the key, that you are already, you know, showing signs of what brought you here today.
Yeah, and I know as a child I hated lies. and there were many lies going on in our family, very many lies. And I did connect to my family. My parents are therapists, yeah? They are truth-searching people, partly at least. And so, and even though, again, very contradicting, but I hated therapy.
Of course.
I didn't want to be transparent or used for therapeutic experiments. I hated that. But then I... even went through the training of turning and becoming a therapist myself. I'm a dance therapist and loved the truth and the truth of the body, and couldn't do any of that anymore. I couldn't dance, I couldn't move, which was a very terrible grief about that, or still can't. But your question about how to come out of it, how was I brought out of it? Yeah, that Yeah, that's all that I can, yeah, that right now comes to me right about that.
Yeah. That was going to be my last question, but I realized I forgot something.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that it's getting long, so I don't want to, you know, keep you any too long. And so just if you don't feel like it's right to answer this, please feel free. But you had mentioned the word research earlier, that you felt that the main purpose that the network had for you had to do with research and that the sexuality was secondary. Is there anything that you would like to share about that?
Mainly, I want to say, oh, if my researching eyes come out at people, please protect yourself because it's dangerous. That's what's coming out right now. But meaning I'm speaking from this perpetrator imitating part or not so imitating that it still wants to help people protect from me, so it can't be the perpetrator entirely, but what I can say is I think I have this researching view on things. And I didn't realize it until not too long ago because I thought it's normal. Everybody has this fixated. And also here is something that's hard to say, but at the same time, it seems like it needs to be said that it has something very what do you call the people that watch in a sexual way?
Oh, voyeur.
Voyeur. It has something about that. So these are inner parts that still try to be on the perpetrator side as a way of protecting that what's very painful. Again, it's going to be very hard for people to understand who have not had that experience, but that's where this research part comes in. Researching how people react under traumatic and overwhelming situations.
So basically, you as a child were used for research in that things were done to you to see how you would react. So you had people who were actually checking and maybe writing down timings and reactions of yours. And again, your survival mechanism, which would be to completely go inside the mind and body of the perpetrator so that you could feel it from their point of view, so that you could do it better in a way to be safe, correct?
Yeah. And there's a very, yeah, exactly. And it somehow doesn't feel like punishment. It feels more like research oriented. And and then also as a very, the effect it has is, I mean, you've said it many times, to be part of the circles, to strengthen that attachment, very strong.
To make you feel you belong?
Yeah, it's still hard for me to believe that that the perpetrators are that clever to, on purpose, do the traumatic things to then make the victim feel as a dissociative process, feel the perpetrator even more, and be through that on their side for safety reasons. Then,
well, it makes you obey.
But Yeah, it seems like it's a science that has grown in a long, 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 long time. And and then with many, many, many thousands of experiments on so many children and people. And so there must be a lot of data.
Well, yes, certainly from my experience, I was not experimented on, not researched, but rather because they were about to create a persona, they used that whatever research they had, and they knew exactly what they were doing to get very precise results. So that was my experience. I was very impressed. But yes, indeed, that requires a lot of research, of course, on human subjects. So, you know, again, I'm very sorry that it was... It is insane. And maybe, yes, it does seem like beyond the pale to think that they would use a child's love, you know, or ability to survive and know exactly what would happen or just see what would happen and how it would affect you and then use that as cold information to create mind control.
Yeah. And this, for some reason, this pops up is that this, it seems like it's a war against life, but also it's an attempt to pull out the pure, something pure from the children, and because that's what is left behind is this feeling of unspeakable, dirty, and filthy feeling that comes up, and it's more work to do, and to allow people to reflect back that maybe I'm not that dirty.
That's for sure. I can reflect that back right now in a very big way. And that also did not succeed in taking that light away from you. And yes, it is a death cult. Absolutely. It's very well put, actually, how you said it. It's all about killing the light, reversing everything, turning everything to darkness. And yet you're sitting here, a beautiful person today, courageously speaking about these things, strong light, beautiful person.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Ellen.